in diagnosing that much of our modern malaise does not come from carrying too much, but from carrying too little. That a myopic focus on personal freedom, the nights out, the me time, the money saved, is a spiritual mirage. You think you want the paradise of nothing ever being asked of you, but it turns out to be the hell of nobody ever needing you.
Must a bakery made of a world. Bakery of a world.
What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have a great little article today. Sorry for the bit of delay. It's been kind of nuts at this house. And I got sick after coming back from Switzerland. It took a couple of days and then it started coming on. I was like, oh no. And we tried to kind of quarantine me, but it cascaded. Rad got sick. Then my wife got sick and Isla got sick. Everybody got sick. And so because of that, I kind of missed some recording time, a lot of recording time, actually. And I've been just kind of doing processing and clerical work and stuff, still trying to get stuff done. But because of that, we had a bit of a lull. Sorry about the missing episodes. But we're back at it. And this article just kind of hit me different. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to read it on the show because I think it's relevant. And especially after reading the Bushido of Bitcoin and, you know, finishing up the narration and stuff for that, which we should be publishing it very soon, and then we're just waiting on Audible. But there's a lot of different values and kind of things that he goes over in that has just, it's made me think about, and it's made me think about the values and the culture that we should attach or think about around Bitcoin, because sound money it doesn't occur in a vacuum. It's about reassessing or realigning us with the real world and actually letting us communicate that kind of skin in the game, that value decisions, those cultural decisions and differences that are actually lost when our money isn't actually a successful communication tool anymore. And touching on a little bit why fiat money produces fiat culture. But that's a bit of a road that we've taken down, and this is less about focusing exactly on the connection between those and more on what isn't fiat culture. So if what we have is fiat culture, then what are we missing? What's the better life? And how could we define or recognize it if we could see it? And the article we're reading is by Heinemeier Hansen, who I don't really know in any other context, but the article is really just about like the idea of consent morality and how we've kind of lost the deeper meaning of values and virtues in this kind of like, as long as you're not hurting anybody, you can do whatever you want and just do what makes you happy, and how kind of empty that message actually is. And I just thought it was a really interesting take. So we'll read that really quick, but first, I just want to thank our sponsors. If you need fiat, if you're trying to access the value of your Bitcoin, but you don't want to let go of your Bitcoin, you can get a Bitcoin-backed loan. No capital gains fees, no credit checks, nothing like that. Go to ledin.io, L-E-D-N.io. And after you've made this decision, you really just want somebody who's boring, who doesn't have a whole bunch of products, and features and yields and all of that stuff, just has a service that works, who's made it through a bear market, who has proof of reserves. You just want someone reliable and trustworthy. You can check them out at my link. It's right down in the show notes, but this is a super valuable tool if you haven't used it. If you're trying to get serious about your light health, check out getchroma.co. I've actually had like a lot of back pain. I still don't understand this one with the whole red light therapy, but I swear to God that crap works. I'm constantly surprised by how much these things affect the body and like my energy levels. And the thing that I really swear by are controlling your blue light exposure for the hours of the day. As someone who's always looking at screens, it makes a huge difference. And Chroma has a ton of great products for this. And they have I have a 10% discount code, Bitcoin Audible. Links and details are all down in the show notes. Now, if you're looking for the news on financial sovereignty, on where governments and institutions and corporations are overreaching the real news for real freedom around the world, check out the Financial Freedom Report. You can subscribe at the link below and obviously follow HRF. And if you want like the source for pulling everybody together that matters in around the world for the fight and voice of liberty, check out their Oslo Freedom Forum. I've actually only been once, and I'm very sad because I really want to go again, but it was an incredible event. You'll find all of that right down in the description. And then lastly, PubKey and the set of tools they have built for creating a new web that is actually sovereign and built on the foundations of things that are already here and that work to give censorship resistance, to put you back in charge of your network. If you're a builder or software developer and you're looking to build tools and systems that are unstoppable and, you know, for Bitcoin and for the future, put this in your list to look at. And you know exactly where to find all the details. All right. With that, let's get into today's read. And it's titled, The Parental Dead End of Consent Morality by David Heinemer Hansen. Consent morality is the idea that there are no higher values or virtues than allowing consenting adults to do whatever they please. As long as they're not hurting anyone, it's all good, and whoever might have a problem with that is by definition a bigot. This was the overriding morality I picked up as a child of the 90s, from TV, movies, music, and popular culture. Fly your freak. Whatever feels right is right. It doesn't seem like much has changed since then. What a moral dead end. I first heard the term consent morality as part of Louise Perry's critique of the sexual revolution. That in the context of hookup culture, situationships, and falling birth rates, we have to wrestle with the fact that the sexual revolution and its insistence that, say, a sky-high body count mustn't be taboo has led society to a screwy dating market in the internet age that few people are actually happy with. But the application of consent morality that I actually find even more troubling is towards parenthood. As is widely acknowledged now, we're in a bit of a birth rate crisis all over the world, and I think consent morality can help explain part of it. I was reminded of this when I posted a cute video of a young girl so over the moon excited for her dad getting off of work, to argue that you'd be crazy to trade that for some nebulous concept of, quote, personal freedom. Predictably, consent morality immediately appeared in the comments. Some people just don't want children, and that's totally okay, and you're actually bad for suggesting they should. No, it's the role of a well-functioning culture to guide people towards the good life. Not force, but guide. Nobody wants to be convinced by the morality police at the pointy end of a bayonet, but giving up on the whole idea of objective higher values and virtues is a nihilistic and cowardly alternative. Humans are deeply mimetic creatures. It's imperative that we celebrate what's good, true, and beautiful, such that these ideals become collective markers for morality, such that they guide behavior. I don't think we've done a good job at doing that with parenthood in the last 30 plus years. In fact, I'd argue we've done just about everything to undermine the cultural appeal of the simple yet divine satisfaction of child rearing, and by extension, maligned the square family unit with mom, dad, and a few kids. Partly out of a coordinated campaign against the family unit as some sort of trad, possibly fascist, identity marker in a long-waged culture war, but perhaps just as much out of the banal denigration of how boring and limiting it must be to carry such simple burdens as being a father or a mother in modern society. It's no wonder that if you incessantly focus on how expensive it is, how little sleep you get, how terrifying the responsibility is, and how much stress is involved with parenthood, that it doesn't seem all that appealing. This is where Jordan Peterson does his best work. in advocating for the deeper meaning of embracing burden and responsibility, in diagnosing that much of our modern malaise does not come from carrying too much, but from carrying too little, that a myopic focus on personal freedom, the nights out, the me time, the money saved, is a spiritual mirage. You think you want the paradise of nothing ever being asked of you, but it turns out to be the hell of nobody ever needing you. Whatever the cause, I think part of the cure is for our culture to re-embrace the virtue and the value of parenthood without reservation, to stop centering the margins and their pathologies, to start centering the overwhelming middle, where most people make for good parents and will come to see that role as the most meaningful part they've played in their time on this planet. But this requires giving up on consent morality as the only way to find our path to the good life. It involves taking a moral stance that some ways of living are better than other ways of living for the broad many, that parenthood is good, that we need more children both for the literal survival of civilization, but also for the collective motivation to guard against the bad, the false, and the ugly. There's more to life than what you feel like doing in the moment. The worst thing in the world is not to have others ask more of you. Giving up on the total freedom of the unmoored life is a small price to pay for finding the deeper meaning in a tethered relationship with continuing a bloodline that's been drawn for hundreds of thousands of years before it came to you. You're never going to be ready before you take the leap. If you keep waiting, you'll wait until the window has closed, and all you will see is regret. Summon a bit of bravery, don't overthink it, and do your part for the future of the world. It's 2.1 or bust, baby. All right, so I want to caveat a few things before we get into this, because I read it to my wife, and because I was curious her thoughts on the article and like the idea that it was pushing, and there, I mean, especially people I've been talking to, like, it's not as if every situation, like marriage and kids, is the way to go, and I think it gets interpreted that way. It's just like, oh, well, just get married, just have kids, because, you know, you could just as easily cause a horrible problem for your kids by marrying the wrong person. You have to have somebody who has your values. Having kids isn't going to fix a rough relationship. And you're talking about an investment that's probably the biggest investment in your entire life. I mean, almost necessarily so when you really think about it. And it's also not inherently a bad thing to not want to do that, or to have a different trajectory in life. It's not as if the only reason to not have kids or to not get married is because you just want to get drunk every night, you don't want to have any responsibilities, and you want to have sex with whoever you want to have sex with. And for some reason in this day and age, it's hard to say this is a valuable life, this is something that I think could add depth and meaning, without someone taking offense that this is the way you must do it in your situation, even though I don't know who I'm talking to, or, you know, whoever's making this suggestion, simply speaking from their experience. And I think when the author posted this on Twitter and got a lot of those responses, they're like, how dare you say I should have to do this? It's just like, there's actually nothing demanding or declarative about, like, you have to do this. He even explicitly says it is about guiding them to what is the most meaningful life. Like, nobody wants to make any decision at the end of a bayonet. In fact, if just me personally, if you want me to make a bad decision, all you have to do is force me, is tell me that I don't have a choice and the only thing I'm allowed to do is make a good decision. I will make a bad decision just to piss you off. So I get that. But when you do have someone that you think you can build a life and a family with, like, having kids has been hard, but, dude, it really changes your perspective. And it happens a little slower than I thought. You know, like, there's certainly the moments where you realize this is my son, you know, like I am here, like this person lives because we are going to take care of them, and we are going to try to lead this person to figuring out how to survive in the world. You know, they're completely dependent on us. It's my responsibility to make sure this kid survives. This kid survives and grows to be a great adult. And when, you know, you're looking into your daughter's eyes and she's just staring at you, and there is this, like, she trusts me. She trusts me to make it work out, to make it better, to fix all the things that are broken. And I don't know what it is about that, but it's heavy. It's heavy, but it's so awesome. And like, I love being a dad. Like, I really wish, we talk about it a lot, that we wish we had done this sooner, because we waited a long time. My wife and I were together for like 10 years or something before we had, like, we were together 4 years before we got married, and then like six or seven years before we finally had Rad. In a lot of ways, we really wish we had done it sooner. And I think we were scared of, like, it wasn't the right time. We weren't ready. We weren't financially stable enough. You know, our ideas actually changed on this, like, while we were together. But it became pretty clear that we wanted to be at home. We wanted to raise our kids. We didn't want to outsource that to public school or whatever. But we never really were ready. You know, like, it was, and you know, I was kind of the same way about asking her to marry me too, is I thought there was going to be this point where it, like, now it makes sense, but it never came. It was always, there's something, I mean, even to this day, there's always something else, like, oh, if I could just finish this, or I could just get over this hump, then it will be done, then things will be stable. Never happened. Not once has it ever happened. And in fact, the closer I got to it, the more I was like, well, I'll just take on this other project, or we'll just do this other thing. So literally, kind of in both situations, it was really, we just kind of got to the point, it's like, what are we waiting for? Like, really? I will say, however, we do kind of go back and forth on having kids, because we're extremely grateful for the massive perspective shift and what we learned from 2020, from the government lockdowns and everything that happened in that era, because it completely changed my perspective and my confidence in standing up against what I always felt were poor decisions and things that just didn't quite line up for me. But, you know, whereas I had these feelings or this sense when it came to money and when it came to politics, and so I had this, like, deep interest, and I just went diving down these rabbit holes for years and years and years, and spending all of my time trying to find the answers for these, well, for myself. Well, in the context of everything that happened around the government lockdowns and the medical system and healthcare in this country, I had never really gone down those rabbit holes. I had never had the time to do that. And that whole era, the zone of everything that happened there, just kind of punched me in the face and shortened that trip quite a bit. And so had we had kids in, you know, 2017 or 2016, like, I know we would have been, like, ecstatic, and I would have been happy to make that realization sooner that, yeah, we should have just had kids. I also know that we would have made some bad decisions, and we wouldn't have pushed back at certain places or looked for certain alternatives, or, you know, people involved. We would have done what the hospital's policy, you know, and everywhere where now we have pushed back against that and we have made our own decisions and we have gone with our alternatives, like we're 100% certain, like, the outcome was just night and day difference. And we kind of have an example because of the degree to which we did with Rad and didn't with our daughter in doing the traditional thing in that context. because even their situations and births went totally differently. So for that reason, I'm really glad we actually did it. We started that journey after 2020. But in the sense of like our age and where we were in life, you know, I wish we could have had kids way sooner. And, you know, my wife and I talk about it quite a bit. And there really is something sick in society today that literally demonizes. And this has been going on for some decades. Like, this isn't something that just popped up overnight. But actually makes it seem backwards and stupid. Or literally the parenthesis that he throws in there of might be fascist to have a stable nuclear family when this is literally the most core piece of the puzzle for society to exist and be sustainable. And I think the consequences of destroying the image of what that really is couldn't be more obvious. The consequences have been very clear, and we are not on a good trajectory. And, you know, this is something that I think libertarians get wrong a lot. You know, this starts out as saying, you know, consent morality is the idea that there are no higher values or virtues than allowing consenting adults to do whatever they please. As long as it's not hurting anyone else, it's all good, and whoever might have a problem with that is by definition a bigot. And I completely agree that not only is this the prevailing narrative or the underlying theme of what has happened to our culture, but it is a total dead end, like a quote-unquote moral dead end. Because the idea, like I do believe in the idea of quote-unquote consent morality when it comes to the use of violence against people. But that does not in any way suggest that there is no other hierarchy of values and there's no comparison within the various cultures that one can engage in or values that one can hold, even among those that are consenting. And like I said, this is something that I think libertarians get wrong, is that libertarianism has nothing to do with culture or values. It's got to do with the moral use of violence. That's it. So when they confuse the idea that one must be completely okay with someone sitting on the sidewalk injecting heroin because you're not allowed to go up and kill that person, or the state's not allowed to put that person in prison because that's initiating violence, that does not at all mean that you also have to just clap for that, you have to just be okay or have no opinion about that person shooting up heroin, sitting on the sidewalk, and, you know, taking a dump on the concrete. The political ideology that is libertarianism deals only with the idea, with the restrictions, and the moral use of violence. As soon as it is outside of that realm, as soon as we've just recognized that you are the evil one, you are the one doing harm if you are beating the crap out of that person or killing that person or putting them in a cage for just having heroin or for shooting up heroin. Well, that says nothing at all about what your opinion about it is or whether or not you should be extremely adamant about whether or not that is a good thing to do in life or whether or not that's healthy for you. It presupposes nothing else about culture or values or how you live, and it doesn't even slightly suggest or mean that one can't have an opinion on those things. In fact, quite the opposite. The whole idea, the reason libertarianism would work is because you would have very strict opinions and very deep cultural ties and family ties that would actually make people live differently and in competition. It's like saying that every business is a good business as long as you're not killing your competition and you're actually just competing on the market. Well, no, That's not true at all. There are sucky businesses. There are businesses that are destined to die. There are unsustainable businesses. There are irresponsible businesses that all that aren't illegal, that aren't doing anything morally reprehensible. But there is a way to do business that is successful and good and sound and sustainable for the long term. And there is bad business. There's a million bad business practices. And the point of the market is to have them actually compete so we can find out what the good way of doing business is. Life and culture is exactly the same way. There are absolutely good cultures and bad cultures. And no, you're not a bigot for thinking that. And in fact, life will never be sustained. You will never actually make progress if you don't recognize that cultures are there to compete. That how you live your life and the decisions you make and the values that you hold and the virtues that you aspire to, they make up everything. You can have the non-aggression principle through to the core, but you can still destroy society by having a crappy virtue and value system on top of that. Society doesn't prosper simply because you're not being evil. It prospers because you value and understand and you reward what is great. And I'm going to repeat this paragraph because I think this is a really important message. It says, I'll go one sentence back just for context. It says, some people just don't want children and that's totally okay and you're actually bad for suggesting they should. No, it's the role of a well-functioning culture to guide people towards the good life. Not force, but guide. Nobody wants to be convinced by the morality police at the pointy end of a bayonet, but giving up on the whole idea of objective higher values and virtues is a nihilistic and cowardly alternative. And what's crazy about what our culture has done is that we've done everything to amplify the worst of the voluntary. What's within the realm of consent morality that could just have the most base kind of get drunk or have sex with whoever you want, what's at the edge of it's still within consent morality, but there's no reason to think it's sustainable or it's better or it's actually going to lead society to any good place, but just what's the most extreme that still exists inside of that card, that box of allowable things? We've amplified everything at the edges. And the simple, natural core of the human species, to have a family, to have kids, to raise them, to literally take on the responsibility of continuing the species, has been kind of put in this box of shut up and just do it. But you're not allowed to say that this is better than whatever crazy thing at the edge of this is. But it's perfectly okay to suggest that everything else is better than the nuclear family. It's so weird. And I think it comes from a place of people are so desperate, looking for meaning, and they don't know where it is. And I think he's right to point out Jordan Peterson, and why Jordan Peterson was so popular, or has become so popular, is the recognition that we have done everything that we can. And this is so deeply tied to the fiat system and the fiat structure of things, that we have offloaded responsibility. We have done everything. We're not responsible for our healthcare. We're not responsible for our home. Everything's on debt. This institution is supposed to provide it for us. This bank is supposed to provide it for us. This government and this politician are supposed to give us what we need. Everything is supposed to be, we're just supposed to have the base, what we need and what we're supposed to get paid and just enough life with just enough comfort, that things aren't supposed to be hard. Things are never supposed to be difficult. We're never supposed to hold too much responsibility because that just makes things frustrating. And then we have to actually struggle. And literally in this endless pursuit of getting rid of responsibility and making everything comfortable, we've made everything so much harder. We have literally enslaved ourselves and we have lost the meaning in life, and we're just chasing, so many people are just chasing this shallow thing, desperate for, okay, well now what the hell does it mean? What's the deeper purpose behind this? And actually taking on that responsibility again is so empowering. That was one of the biggest things that I learned, you know, probably is, I think it was shortly after college, is to recognize that everything is your fault. And some people get immediately defensive. They're like, what? It's not my fault. This person did this to me. And, you know, I got fired and it was a situation that was out of my control and blah, blah, blah. And to not realize how defeating that mentality is. And it's not about pointing the blame. It's about wanting the blame. It's about wanting things to be under your power. If everything is your fault, if everything in your situation, if everything that happens to you is your fault, it means that you can do something about it. It's a great thing because it means that it's within your power to actually fix. And for the longest time, I wanted everything to be somebody else's fault, partly because it just makes me feel better about myself. Like I just don't want, because something bad happened and it was a terrible situation. And of course, you know, sometimes you draw bad cards and shit goes sideways. But I was going out of my way to eliminate where I could think about how I got myself into that situation or how I didn't make a different decision coming out of it. And I was purposefully putting like that mindset, like, what is going on in my brain when I say that person did it to me, or I can't have this because these other people are getting in my way, or they don't believe it, or they're not going to let me have it. I'm literally saying I am a slave. I'm saying that I can't get it until I convince those other people to give it to me. If it's somebody else's fault, if I don't have a girlfriend because girls are stupid and they don't like nice guys. This was something, a big problem that I had when I was like, when I was younger and I was really insecure. This whole idea of like nice guys finish last, when really what was happening is that like I didn't have any confidence. I would go into a room convinced that, you know, the pretty girls weren't going to like me or I wasn't going to be funny. And I would literally wear that on my, like I would walk around with the body language that screamed that. And all anybody did with the invisible communication that I provided in the room was basically take me at my word. If I opened my mouth and I sounded like I didn't believe I was going to be funny or this joke wasn't going to land or this girl wasn't going to like me, well, she's just going to assume that, like, why wouldn't she just assume that I was right? Oh, well, he knows himself better than I know him. So if he doesn't have any confidence to walk up and say something to me, convinced that I might actually like him or we might actually have a relationship together, then, well, then, yeah, sure, I'm not going to be attracted to that. But if it's my fault, if it's how I'm acting, if it's the things that I'm putting off when I walk into a room, that means I can change. That means I can fix it. That means this problem is not permanent and intractable. This problem is just my framing. It's how I walk into the room. It's the fact that I don't believe I'm good enough, and I just have to believe that I'm good enough. Like, I can do it. I just can. Why would somebody else be able to succeed at this and not me? You know, why would somebody else be able to figure out Paradrive, but I'm not able to do so? Bullshit. I can figure it out. I don't care if it takes me three times as long. Sure, I'll make a hell of a lot of mistakes, but I'm going to figure it out. I just am. Yes, I can have a successful podcast. As there are idiots, there are total idiots that have successful podcasts. I am smarter than that person. Sure, I don't know exactly how to do it right now. Sure, there's going to be a ton of people who don't like me or who don't want to hear me rant about some bullshit for 30 minutes. Because damn it, if I can be long-winded if I can be anything. But if you give me 1,000 episodes and enough time to work on it, I bet I can figure out how to be succinct. Stuff happens. Things do happen to me. There are things out of my control. But what I do with it is totally in my control. Where I am and what my situation is like within the space that the universe allots to me is my fault. And that's the best news ever. Because all I have to do is take responsibility for it. All I have to do is recognize that. And now every problem is solvable. Every last one of them, because it's my fault. And it doesn't matter what somebody else did. I shouldn't have been, you know, if somebody else screws me, I shouldn't have been with that person. I shouldn't have worked with that person. And now that just means that all I have to do is replace that person. Or I have to figure out why it is in our relationship or the thing that we're working on that there's a miscommunication and I'm resisting doing something that just needs to be done to correct it. And yeah, at first it feels a whole lot better, and it's easier to sit down and think, that person did that to me, and you know, this wasn't my fault, and to try to offload that responsibility. And in the short term, that kind of feels better. But honestly, in the long term, like, you kind of rot out the foundation of yourself because you just let yourself believe that life is happening to you. Sure, I can't control the waves, but I steer the damn ship. Like, I am captain. And I think there's something in there about why parenthood is such a shift. And I think part of it is because, like, that little kid that, you know, my son and my daughter look at me and I am the captain. Like I am responsible for them, and they see me as the one with all the solutions. And I don't have the privilege of pushing that off because I refuse to make them think that they're going to grow up and life is going to happen to them, and that they can't succeed because of their skin color or because of the political jurisdiction that they live in, or because they're not pretty enough, or they're not smart enough. Like, that's bullshit. And I also know that when things don't go right or I don't make the right decision, I can't just push it off onto somebody else and be like, well, you should have done this for my kids, or somebody should have given me a manual for this. No, like, I have to figure this out. And I can see that whole picture in my mind when they are just looking at me in the eyes and I realize what they see. That daddy will take care of it. I want to carry that. I want to be that for my kids. In fact, I am that whether I do a good job or not. So then the question is, am I up for the challenge, or am I going to go sit in bed and just feel sorry for myself? And there's so many things. Like, before we had kids, there were so many things. All I could think is, like, what we were going to lose. You know, this is another section that he does, like, a really good job talking about, like, rather than talking about, you know, the quote-unquote, the design satisfaction of child rearing, which just so, so true. But the quote, it's no wonder that if you incessantly focus on how expensive it is, how little sleep you get, how terrifying the responsibility is, and how much stress is involved with parenthood, that it doesn't seem all that appealing. Before we had kids, that is what I saw. Like, I knew we wanted a family, but all I saw was like, oh, we're not going to be able to go out and drink, we're not going to be able to hang out with our friends, and all this stuff, like, we're barely going to get any sleep. Like, it was just, here's all the hard things about it. And there are definitely those days where, you know, Rad, our son, is just, nah, he didn't have good sleep, and he is just upset about every little thing. And then our daughter is just, she just turned 5 months, and she's just screaming, and the whole house is just screaming, and everybody's scrambling to do something, and we can't make any progress, and it just feels so overwhelming. Like, without a doubt, those moments happen, and that's not totally infrequent either. Like, life is it's a little bit crazy with kids. But then there's just these days or moments where, like, we're, you know, just sitting outside, and, you know, Rad's playing t-ball by himself. He's, what, three in a couple of months now. And, or I'm throwing the ball to him, and we're just sitting out in the sun, and Isla's just, like, playing, just staring at her hands like they're the most fascinating thing in the world. And, like, you know, my wife and I will just, like, look at each other, and there will just be this moment. I'll just be like, this is the happiest I have ever been. And nothing even really happened, you know? I'm just so overwhelmed with, like, what we made and what we're making work. And, dude, watching my son learn and, like, figure things out and come to realizations is the coolest thing in the whole world. And to get to kind of see life again through his perspective, where everything is fresh, and to realize that, you know, I have to explain, like, it's so much harder to explain stuff to my son than it is to explain Bitcoin to, you know, people on this show. I get to use a bunch of big words and framing and analogies and all of these things, and none of that crap makes any sense to him. I have to pause and reframe things so many times while I'm talking to him and realize that he has no context for this. Like, how on earth do I explain this thing within his little world and what he understands? But it is just one of the greatest things ever. It's just, and I don't really miss all the stuff we used to do. You know, all the things that I thought, oh, we weren't going to be able to do this, and we can't do this anymore. Like, I just, like, I don't know, maybe if I got like a couple of free weeks to go, no, it's not. I don't want to do it anymore. When I go out to conferences and stuff, like, I like to, you know, go hang out with people and be extroverted, and I'll still drink a drink or two every once in a while, but I don't know. I don't need to do that. I just want to get home. I want to be with my family. I want to see my kids. And holy crap, they change so much. When I'm gone for like 5 days or something, I come back and Isla's doing something completely different. She's just a whole different little girl. Like, it's definitely hard. It's definitely hard. But if I had to make a simple analogy for it, is, you know, previously to starting a family or whatever, there was one project that I always had in my mind that I was going to do. In fact, take that back. I act like this is now gone. This is not gone. I'm still totally going to do this. And now I'm more convinced than ever that I actually have a timeline, and I know, well, you know, rough timeline. And who knows how long anything takes. But I have a path to actually seeing this through. I'm going to make a feature film. I want to make a film. And it was always this thing that was off in the distance, and I never had like a concrete way to achieve it. But, you know, if you take on a movie project, if you take on like a huge dream for something that you wanted to do, it's not easy. Like, you'll probably, like, if I was in the middle of making a movie right now, it'd probably be the busiest I'd ever been. But when I'm telling people about, you know, why I'm making a movie, it's not because of all the work. It's because of what I'm creating. What's important about making the film or telling a beautiful or fascinating story isn't all the complications and lost sleep and all of that stuff. Like, I wouldn't care that I have to do those things to complete the project because of how awesome the project is, because of how important it is to me. That's kind of what it's like to, you can probably hear her screaming in the background right now, but that's how I would analogize. Like, if I had to explain what it's like to have kids, is, yes, it's crazy hard. There's sleepless nights. It's absolutely a wild roller coaster. And there are moments where you are just like, what in the hell? Everybody, please shut up. But it's also just like the most meaningful and most important project that I've ever worked on. You know, I don't regret it because it's hard. In fact, that's kind of what makes it so awesome. Everything that I build in life, you know, even the literal greatest of great things, like if I built freaking pyramids in my life as like some sort of thing that lasted for 10,000 years, it's still going to be temporary. It's still like, you know, this, I love this podcast and, you know, what we've made with it. I would love if I'd made a feature film. I'm going to write a book, like all of these things. I'm going to build Pear Drive. There's all these things that I want to do, but they all pale in comparison to literally my family and my kids. Because all those things, as soon as I'm gone, none of that stuff's going to last. Nobody's going to host a podcast for 100 years that's literally a century out of date. Nobody's going to go back and listen to that. Nobody's going to care what my salary was or how cool the company that I worked with was or how useful the Pear Drive app was. Somebody's going to build something cooler or on top of it, or the idea that it's going to be some foundational piece of the internet. Sure, I'd love that. And I'm still just going to build on the assumption that it will get there. But I have no guarantee of that. I don't really know. I'm just gonna try. I'm not gonna give up on it. But really, in 20 years, 50 years, how much is it gonna matter? Who's still gonna be using it instead of the next thing? But my kids will still be here. They'll be having their own kids, and what I teach them and the values that I instill in them and the kind of person, the strength that I leave them with is going to matter. And it's going to matter indefinitely and exponentially, actually, because it will still matter a generation after generation after generation after generation. My kids are without question my most important and longest lasting project. They are by every measure the most important part of my legacy. And even if somehow I build something great, the whole idea is to instill in them or to show them that they could potentially build something even greater when the foundation down the line for the technological capabilities and society and everything, what is needed in the world, and I could give them a footing to stand on to build something even greater than I did. I don't know. It's just how I've come to see it. But this line in particular from the article I thought was just really cool. It just hit me a certain way. It says that a myopic focus on personal freedom, the nights out, the me time, the money saved, is a spiritual mirage. You think you want the paradise of nothing ever being asked of you, but it turns out to be the hell of nobody ever needing you. And there's just a really powerful grain of truth in that. When somebody needs you, or when someone demands more of you, and you consciously make the choice to step up to the plate and swing as hard as you can, there's just something great in it. That's just my two cents, I guess. Thank you guys for listening. I guess we'll close this out. A link to the work, and also watch the video. Watch the video, because there is... He has a link in the thing. In fact, I'll just post the link to the post in the show notes of just this little girl who is... Like incomprehensibly excited to have her dad come and be off work. Literally the happiest video. Just you can't not smile. So check that out. And a lot of great resources. A huge shout out to our sponsors. And use the link in the show notes if you're trying not to sell your Bitcoin and you want to get a loan. Seriously, this is an extremely useful tool. Like, be careful with it, but Ledin.io has made this stupid easy. The Financial Freedom Report, I love both the HRF just in general, but the work that they do, the Oslo Freedom Forum, check them out if you haven't. I'm super excited about what the guys are building over with PubKey, and we're even looking at ways to potentially utilize this with PearDrive, and then get Chroma. Like I said, I've been very serious about health and, you know, taking that responsibility on, and I'm not very trustworthy of the you know, medical industry today. And Light Health is absolutely one of those things that gets totally neglected and has an enormous effect. And that's what Get Chroma does. And there's a 10% discount in the show notes. But all my links down there, and there's also, you know, place to buy Bitcoin, just a number of resources that people regularly ask me about and things that I really enjoy or really trust. So check those out, and using those links specifically helps me, especially with the sponsors. So if you do, I'd appreciate it, and thank you guys. With that, I'm Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. Don't forget to subscribe, and I will catch you guys on the next one. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys.
Can you say it? Can you say the best in Bitcoin?
That is Bitcoin.
Say it real loud and with a lot of energy. Say, the best in Bitcoin.
That is Bitcoin.
Made Audible.
Made Audible.
This is Bitcoin Audible.
Bitcoin Audible.
love you, kid. Thank you.